If you ask people in Kansas City what we could do to make our city better, you'll hear a strong desire to see a more integrated city, neighborhoods where people of different colors and backgrounds live side by side and hang out together. We hear it all the time on this show from our guests and our callers. So if everyone pretty much wants an integrated city, why don't we have one? Isn't it up to us? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear about one possible explanation. It's something called implicit bias, and it might just kick in when we're making those decisions about where to live, where to play, and who's safe to talk to. Robin Wright is with us from Ohio State University's Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
We're also joined by Gwen Grant for this discussion. Gwen heads up the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. Welcome back to the show, Gwen.
Thank you, Gina.
So, Gwen, let's stick with this issue of why Kansas City isn't more integrated, just for a moment. You were part of a panel that I moderated at the library in the fall, and during that discussion, you suggested that the real problem is that Kansas Cityans, even well-meaning Kansas Cityans, are scared of Black people and don't move to neighborhoods where they predominantly live. I should add that you suggested that avoiding those parts of town isn't just something white people do.
That's true. And I think that many of these behaviors are, I think the root cause is implicit bias, that subconscious cognitive function of our brain that we are totally unaware of. And I believe that most often people are if you were to ask them, they'd say, you know, I'm not racist, I'm not bigoted, I believe in equal opportunities for everyone, but yet the decisions they make don't necessarily line up with that. And our implicit biases also don't line up with our basic values and beliefs or the basic beliefs that we would espouse in public.
When you talk about the decisions we make, let's zero in a little bit on real estate decisions.
Okay. I think that people are more likely to want to live in neighborhoods with people who look like them. And that explains why we have so much segregation in Kansas City. And those biases or those feelings that cause us to make those decisions are not necessarily based in actual facts relative to what it's like to live in a community that is racially and ethnically diverse.
What are some of the subtle ways you might observe that in, say, real estate interactions or other interactions? I mean, not just the decisions themselves, but maybe some of the little giveaways.
Well, if you think about the real estate community, you know, I would say it would show up in redlining. It would show up in with realtors not showing properties to Blacks, not showing them properties in suburban communities, or if they encounter a white family or a white couple who wants to purchase a home, who wants to say they want to live in an urban community, and real estate agents will actually steer them to other areas. They will assume, like, no, you really don't want to live here. Let me show you properties here. So that's one way that it can show up in a real estate function.
If segregated patterns of behavior are so persistent, in part because of something we don't even recognize or want to be there in ourselves, that seems so much harder to fix than, say, a policy that's flawed. Or is it?
Well, it's easier to address policies than it is to address the decisions and the behaviors of the people who are supposed to enact those policies. The thing about implicit bias that is important is, well, explicit bias is much easier to deal with. You have an explicit bias, you can develop a policy, a law. I mean, we have the Constitution, we have the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We have policies in our businesses that say we're going to have promote diversity and inclusion. Yet, all of these disparities continue to persist. Our communities remain segregated. And so that has to tie to how people behave, how they function day to day. And implicit bias, our subconscious mind, impacts that.
Robin, you are somewhat of an expert on implicit bias. You're really at the forefront of studying the phenomenon. What do we need to understand about it before we really dig into how it affects our lives and this city, Kansas City in particular?
Yes, thank you for that question. But first, I want to touch on something that Ms. Gwynn said. So with regards to housing and implicit bias, it's important to understand that a lot of the housing patterns that we see also derive from structural inequities, as she touched on redlining and things like that. And we know from the housing crash in 2008 that subprime lending disproportionately happened in communities of color. And the legacies of those policies and those practices of the past century are still lingering today and affecting the ways in which folks move throughout cities and where we live.
So they linger. Can I just touch on that, though, quickly? When you say they linger today, I mean, you're talking about that they linger within institutions and within procedures and things like that. But, I mean, our behavior is part of the way they linger through implicit bias?
Yes. Yes, and that's where I was going next, definitely. So you have perceptions and attitudes that we all have about different groups of people. And as Gwynn was saying, they may not necessarily align with our explicit values. And so we may associate certain parts of town, for instance, with certain groups of people or perhaps we're not just associating those parts of towns with a group of people in particular. Perhaps it's just that side of town has a lot more crime, and the crime and the population on that side of town where there's higher crime just so happened to be black or brown. And so the real reason, you know, people will say the reason I don't want that side of town is because of crime, not realizing that it also has to do with the group of people that inhabits that side of town. So particularly drawing from some research that was done several years ago, there's actual research to demonstrate that oftentimes our perceptions of crime rates in neighborhoods don't actually align with real data. And there's some research that has suggested that folks are more likely to perceive higher crime rates as the proportion of the population of Black Americans increases in that neighborhood, even if the crime rates themselves aren't higher. So we may be saying explicitly, oh, it has nothing to do with race. It has nothing to do with ethnicity. It has everything to do with me wanting to live in a safer part of town. But nonetheless, our perceptions of safe could be skewed based on the populations in those areas.
What made you want to start to look into this? Did something in your own life trigger your interest in implicit bias?
Wow. Well, as an African American, there's so many things that has triggered my interest in implicit bias. One instance that I will probably never forget was when I was in undergraduate school, and at the time I was engaging in an applied math major, and I'm sitting in a physics lab, and I have two partners, and we didn't self-select our partners. Our professor grouped us together, and I was in a group with a white male and a white female, and I noticed that every time I offered a suggested answer or every time I attempted to contribute an idea to any of our projects, the white female in the group would turn to the white male and essentially get his approval on my thought process. I saw that my competence was being questioned constantly in that group dynamic. And she was very, very nice. It wasn't any overt hostility between us and amongst us in our group. Nonetheless, it was very clear that she saw his competence as being higher than mine.
And maybe and so even higher than her own, interestingly.
Exactly, because she was even placing his thoughts and his ideas above her own. You're correct. And so it's little instances like that that has guided me toward where I am today, working at the Kerwin Institute, focusing on implicit bias, because there was just so much about my lived experience that was not easily explained by just looking at institutional and structural inequities and overt biases, because the people around me all seemed so nice. Yet I was still having a very different experience. And for me, implicit bias helped add to that picture. It's a piece of the puzzle to help me make sense of my lived experience.
this is maybe a difficult question, but have you ever observed yourself on the other end of that scenario, caught yourself in a fleeting thought or behavior that totally goes against what you consciously believe?
Yes. That is a very difficult question. But in the spirit of transparency, yes, I have definitely caught myself on the other side of that. I've had situations where even just at the university that I work at now at Ohio State, I've had situations where I felt myself tensing up in certain moments. And when I look around and I actually check the evidence, there was really no logical reason for me to tense up other than my own unconscious fear of the people around me that was completely unwarranted. But I must say it takes a certain level of introspection to even be able to recognize that you are having a physiological response to someone that doesn't actually align with the reality of the situation.
How do you think that the way we talk about race changes when we see the problem as something happening totally under the radar? I mean, even under our own radar, even like the quote unquote perpetrator's radar. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think it opens folks up to actually engaging in a discussion around race. So often and historically in our society, because we have dealt with so much overt racism and so much structural institutional biases, the conversation is essentially populated by people of color and our allies in the white community. And so oftentimes the everyday middle class white American is unwilling to engage in the discussion because it's very much an accusatory, hostile tone. And historically speaking, that tone might have made sense at some points in time. And not that there still isn't overt biases, nonetheless, actually shifting the conversation to our unconscious associations, I have found have made white Americans more willing to actually engage in the discussion. And that's not to say that individuals are absolved from responsibility because something is happening unconsciously, but nonetheless, it shifts the discussion to one that's talking about how do our minds work and how can we understand the ways in which we build associations about different groups of people and how that might realistically be impacting how we perceive others and how can we move past that. It opens up the acknowledgement.
Do you think that implicit bias in human minds is what creates racist systems and institutions? Or do you think that implicit bias comes from those systems and institutions, like from the way racist messages get rehashed before our eyes, whether we're consuming them through like TV shows and movies or various real life scenarios we've been exposed to?
Yeah, that's sort of the chicken and the egg question. So it's difficult to say. There's personally, I think it's very much interconnected. I think they're both feeding into each other, which is why at the Kerwin Institute, we focus on both our cognition as well as structural inequalities, because we recognize that these things are not operating separately. They're overlapping. They're operating in tandem with one another. And so I think it's difficult to say which comes first. I think they're just feeding into each other, honestly.
Gwen, what do you think about this? I mean, especially as it applies to life in Kansas City.
Well, I agree with Robin. I don't think you can separate implicit and explicit. I think they're definitely intertwined. And to have a conversation about implicit bias does not remove the need to address structural inequities. I think what it does is it sets the stage to begin to figure out how more effectively to remove structural barriers to get the people who are responsible for implementing these policies to recognize their own personal biases and then to put new systems in place so that we have a way to mitigate our own behaviors in these situations. There are things you can do. For instance, if you're an educator and you're concerned about how implicit bias is impacting decisions in the classroom, what does the curriculum look like that the teacher is imparting to the students? What are the disciplinary policies? So how do you then create a process that can prevent or at least would foster the types of behaviors that would certainly minimize the impact that implicit bias can have on a group of people within a system?
How might a teacher's implicit bias play out in the classroom?
Well, it can certainly play out in with discipline. I think it would be Robin, I know at Kerwin, they've done some research and they have numbers that where you can validate disciplinary disparities, black children being disciplined differently and more often than whites. And the Department of Justice issued a report a few years ago demonstrating how black boys particularly were suspended more frequently, tracked to special education more frequently. And these outcomes tend to relate to implicit bias.
Well, I'm going to ask our listeners to do something kind of difficult. I want people to call in and tell us about a time when you said or did something that revealed to you a bias, even a slight one that you didn't know you harbored. Did someone point it out to you? How did you feel when you had to face this side of yourself? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. And Gwen, aside from real estate and education, which we've touched on, though I'm sure we'll get back to those, how do you think implicit bias affects the big picture of life in Kansas City?
Wow, that's a big question. I think if we, as Kansas Cityans, have the will or make an intentional choice to begin to think about our biases and how we personally can take steps to address them, I think that can move us along the pathway to becoming a more diverse and inclusive community. I would hope that the work that we're doing all of next week with the Kerwin Institute will provide an opportunity for us to educate and engage audiences around the impact of implicit bias in law enforcement, healthcare, education, and employment.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the occasion right now. There are talks about implicit bias coming up all around town. We've got implicit bias in law at the Jackson County Courthouse. And these are not all public events. A lot of them are trainings that are specific to the communities they address. But implicit bias in law at the Jackson County Courthouse, implicit bias in health at the Health Department over on Troost, implicit bias in employment at the Federal Reserve Bank. Let's dip in a little bit to these arenas.
Can I chime in
for
just
please.
A second? So in regards to the big picture, there's a lot of research that suggests that when you're interacting with someone that you have a negative or a negative implicit bias against one of their identities, then you're more likely to exhibit microaggressions. And so even when it comes to the big picture in the day-to-day lives of average, everyday Americans in Kansas City or anywhere else in our nation, we know that folks, when interacting with someone they're biased against, is more likely to have more speech hesitations, to have fewer impromptu comments, smile less, something as simple as smiling less when you're interacting with someone you're implicitly biased against. There's so much research that's looked at even the idea within the healthcare realm of verbal dominance and this idea that doctors are more likely to allow more speaking time for patients that they are not biased against than those they are unconsciously biased against. And so even down to the everyday interactions amongst neighbors, that can be manifested in different ways. And in addition to that, even the decisions that we're making in regards to how we're evaluating applicants in employment arenas, how we're interacting, for instance, a receptionist, how a receptionist may interact with a patron at the library, for instance. There's so many different ways that microaggressions manifest, oftentimes resulting from unconscious bias. And it's part of the reason why you have oftentimes minority populations who are saying, oh my gosh, there's so much bias, there's so much racism, and oftentimes white America is saying, what are you talking about? I treat everybody nicely, because you're not even aware of the microaggressions that may be manifesting from unconscious bias.
You know, Robin, I'm curious about something. I mean, is it sometimes hard to tease apart a bias from, like, almost a cultural barrier of some kind? Because sometimes it seems like a history of segregation has obviously led people to kind of group with people who look like they do and come from the same kinds of backgrounds that they do. And within those communities, you develop certain codes for the way you talk, the way you interact. And when those when people from those different groups come together, it's hard to know the difference between when someone is biased against someone or when people just have trouble communicating because they kind of don't know each other's unspoken rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's actually a lot of research that looks at the challenges inherent in intergroup cross-cultural relations. So as you said, we're not used to interacting with people who are different than us. And even beyond just the racial differences, class differences are really, really important as well. Someone from a lower class community don't know the normative interaction and behavioral expectations of middle and upper class America, for instance. And so there's a lot of research that has come out related to what's called racial anxiety. So that idea that the discomfort with people who are different than you creates an anxiety in those interaction moments where you're expected to engage in a meaningful way. And what I would say is, whether or not that discomfort comes from a bias or just from an unfamiliarity, the manifestation of that discomfort remains the same. And I believe that implicit bias and utilizing this framework of implicit bias helps us to create space where we can begin to try to bear that tension of discomfort, because it is going to be a period of discomfort as you're interacting with someone and you don't know their normative behaviors of what is expected. You don't understand the nonverbal cues in their interactions with you and with others. And that can be a very anxiety-producing experience, but we're going to have to bear that tension. And I think implicit bias allows us to give the benefit of the doubt that folks are well-meaning, allowing us to, instead of having an accusatory tone, actually recognize that they're well-meaning. Let's see how we can work together and get over this anxiety so we can get to a place where we feel connected with one another.
Gwen wants to jump in here.
Yeah, I want to say something to add to the point about the impact of anxiety. We published the State of Black Kansas City report in 2015 with the focus on urban health. And one of the health articles, the research, one of the contributors wrote about the impact of anxiety and stress on the disproportionate impact it has for African Americans in corporate America. So basically, studies have shown that Blacks are more likely to suffer from this anxiety because of having to show up in corporate America where they are in the minority and deal with the climate for them that, of course, if you were to ask anyone else, any white person in the workplace, everything's great here. We have diversity programming, but there's a lot of stress and anxiety, and it impacts the health. So they see a lot of chronic illnesses as a result of that.
Wow. Well, when KCUR Central Standard returns, if implicit bias is the cause of persistent inequality, where will change come from? How to use the concept for personal and social progress in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about implicit bias. That is a really insidious, subconscious little kernel of prejudice that could and probably does exist within all of us, if we're honest. My guests are Gwen Grant of the Urban League and national researcher Robin A. Wright. We're taking your calls and confessions about your own experiences with implicit bias at 816-235-2888. And Robin, is there a difference between how we deal with implicit bias on an individual level and how we deal with it on an institutional level?
Absolutely. They're interconnected, of course, but there are differences. And I should say that a lot of the research that I've talked about is available publicly at the Kerwin Institute's website in our State of the Science Implicit Bias Review documents. But in regards to dealing with our implicit biases, on the individual level, a lot of it has to do with intention, attention, and time. So having the intention to change your implicit associations, whether it be through mindfulness and meditation, which have been found to be extremely effective at increasing... because there's certain characteristics of our unconscious cognition that creates certain situations where we're more likely to engage in that unconscious processing and allow that to take the driver's seat. So when our cognitive load is compromised, for instance, if we have so many things that we're trying to do at the same time, or if we're extremely tired, if we're not in the moment, we're more likely to exhibit and make decisions on our unconscious biases. And mindfulness actually reduces that cognitive load and creates the space for us to make more present and more unbiased decisions throughout our day. And so that's one really good way to begin to change it on the individual level. Another way is just through intergroup contact. As I said, it can be very anxiety producing, but actually having interactions with people who are different than you in a cooperative setting where you're working toward a common goal is really, really important. To changing our implicit associations. It's giving us an alternative idea about that people group that may contrast with the stereotypes and the images that we've received through media. And so a lot of the work on the individual level is very tedious, but it is definitely useful. So taking the intention and attention and knowing that it's going to take time and persistence.
Well, yeah. On the go on, please.
Sorry. On the institutional level, there are, as I was saying, there are certain moments where we're susceptible. So high ambiguity, when there's incomplete information in situations like that, if there's anything that you can do as an institution to create more clarity in your decision-making processes, the better. So, for instance, I always use the example of hiring. So if, you know, at most institutions, we say, we want someone who fits in the culture of our institution. But what does fit mean? If you don't define fit, then everyone in that committee that's hiring that next person is going to define it differently. And more often than not, fit simply just means someone like me. And so we end up perpetuating these undiverse outcomes in our employment because we're not being articulate about what exactly we're seeking to do. So any way you can minimize the ambiguities and create clarity in our processes and procedures within institutions, the better.
Let's hear what Charles in Kansas City has to say about implicit bias. Hi, Charles.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning to you, too.
I enjoy this conversation. I think implicit bias is a nice way of defining these kinds of prejudice. But I would like to add a term because I deal with a lot of different cultures, and I think cultural bias is a term that should be added to the conversation because a lot of things get defined as racism, when in fact they are cultural ignorance. It is simply the fact that people have not been exposed to a certain culture and they display their ignorance. And that's, I would confess that I have been culturally ignorant in my life and had to learn about new cultures. And certainly those cultures sometimes are of a different race. But I think that a lot of times people get accusatory of about being racist when in fact they're culturally ignorant. And if you travel abroad and go different places in the world, you'll find that the same type of implicit bias exists in various cultures.
Hey, Charles, I'd like to jump in and ask you a little bit. You said that you have been culturally ignorant at times in your life and had to learn. I mean, can you quickly walk us through how you went that process for yourself? Because a lot of people probably are just scared to be in that position of not knowing and of potentially revealing that they don't know.
Okay, I'll give it a try. When I was a young boy, I moved out into a rural area, a farm area, and I moved from the suburbs to a rural area. I'm a 55-year-old white man. And so when I was a boy, I moved out to a rural area, and I was around farm culture, what I guess I'll call farm culture. And I was culturally ignorant in that situation and had to learn about that culture, which was deeply provincial. And then I became a musician, and I started to go into the cities and work with musicians, and I started to work in the black communities playing music. And I had a completely different cultural experience, and yet again I was culturally ignorant during those early teen years and early 20s about what the black community and the black culture was all about, and I had to take my time and learn. I had to stumble sometimes and put my foot in my mouth sometimes, but I was willing to take those risks and to learn those lessons, and I'm very glad I did. I'm glad I had both experiences, both in rural farm communities and in urban black communities, because I feel much richer and much more happy as a person.
Yeah, I want to get some feedback from our guests. Gwen, can you talk to me about, like, he's talking about a very specific kind of experience in many ways to Kansas City, the rural-urban divide, a racial divide that he crossed, it sounds like, through music. But this distinction he's drawing between ignorance and bias, do you think there's a difference?
Well, I think certainly there's a connection between ignorance and bias, absolutely. I mean, people most often are acting from a place of ignorance, lack of information, lack of knowledge about the realities of people versus perceptions that they have, basis how they've informed their opinions through their own personal experiences or the media. I do think that what I heard the caller say also that is critical is he talked about he was willing to take the risk to push to move into the unknown in these relationships and willing to jump in and make a mistake if possible or if necessary to learn and grow in the process. And I think that's a really important thing as we go forward with having these dialogue sessions throughout next week with the Kerwin Institute and many of the other folks involved, such as a number of corporations locally like Hallmark Cards and the Federal Reserve Bank and UMB and others, the Reach Healthcare Foundation. These people want to have these conversations, and there's risk involved in having them because, you know, it can go any way. I think implicit bias, though, is going to be the easiest way to approach it. And so we have to be open to there's a little discomfort when you come to the table to talk about this stuff, but come with an open mind and the willingness to learn, and it'll be just fine.
Robin, I want to get your input because on both sides, it seems like the willingness not only to make a mistake, but I don't want to say to let someone make a mistake because, of course, it's not productive if it goes unchecked. But how does someone who observes that, like, hey, like, you've got some weird ideas here that are coming through that you're expressing, and I want to correct them. How do you do that in a way that isn't shutting down the conversation and isn't accusatory like we've talked about?
Yeah, I think Well, first, I would like to say that I think there is a difference between ignorance and bias. As the gentleman was articulating, cultural bias and just not knowing. It's one thing to not understand someone who's different than you or an environment or context that you're unfamiliar with. It's another thing to have a negative association about that. And ignorance sometimes feeds into that fear and feeds into that that negative feeling, but it's not necessarily a different conversation.
Yeah, ignorance is a little more neutral.
Yeah, ignorance can be neutral, but we know from data and research like Project Implicit, where you can take the implicit association test and uncover some of your implicit biases, that there are attitudes, but there's also stereotypes that are very harmful that we have against different groups of people, and that influences our decisions. And so I do want to make that distinction.
Yeah.
In regards to how to come to the table and help essentially hold individuals accountable for their implicit biases, I think that's a very difficult thing to tackle. I hesitate to make a very general and like all situation applicable suggestion, but I will say that, and this is just coming from a framework of an African-American woman who have been on the receiving end of those biases, I think approaching it from the perspective of, I hate to say this, but approaching it from a perspective of compassion and love, I think is critical. It's difficult, and the reason I hesitate to say this is because as Black people and as people of color, as women, we are constantly, historically, we have constantly been in situations where we're expected to essentially give white middle class America and upper class America a pass essentially for their bigotry, whether it's intentional or unintentional. And I don't think it's fair to continue to put the onus on those who are on the receiving end of discrimination to do that. But I do think that it's the only way it'll happen. I don't know another way that we can create space for people to make mistakes without shutting them down to the point where the conversation stops.
Yeah.
And so I think approaching it from a perspective of compassion, so articulating, giving them the benefit of the doubt and articulating to them, you know, like, hey, when you said that or when you did that, I'm noticing something here, and it's this is how I'm perceiving it.
Yeah.
Is this what you're intending?
Let's quickly take a call from Jill in Gladstone. Hi, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's the story you want to share?
Well, I actually grew up and went to a prestigious Catholic school here in Gladstone. And then at 15 years old, I went and moved to the city to live with my dad. And I was forced to see things differently because it was a completely different, two different cultures. And one of the things that I remember is just thinking about when my friends would come over to my house and say, I'd like to, my mom would answer the door and they would say, I'd like to see Jill, and here she is. And she's down the hall and go get her. And then I would come, you know, to my friend's house, maybe in the city, and say, you know, I'd like to speak with my friend. And, you know, and their parents would kind of get offended and I didn't understand it. My friend was like, you didn't even say hi, Mrs. Such and Such. This is her house. And I didn't realize that, like, in my house, I don't have time. My mom was like, I don't have time to deal with you. I've got other things to do. But in that, it was more of a just the differences in opinions. And now my best friend, who happens to be African-American, we get to have great discussions about being offended and how could this person do things. And then you go, but did you look at it from this side? Oh, no, I didn't think about it from that side. And so we get to bounce ideas off of each other to try and come up with, like, maybe I'm only looking at it from my way of.
You're coming up with solutions.
Yes.
I'm Gina Kaufman.
Yes.
Stay with me through the break. We'll wrap up this discussion of implicit bias in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Gwen Grant and researcher Robin A. Wright. We're talking about the invisible force of implicit bias in our personal interactions and in reinforcing citywide and sometimes regional or even nationwide patterns of inequality. And guys, I'm curious about whether you feel hopeful when you think about racism in terms of implicit bias, or if that's a discouraging way of thinking about it in some ways. I'll start with you, Robin.
Yes, I am extremely hopeful. If I were not hopeful, I would not be doing what I do every day in working toward mitigating implicit bias and other forms of inequality. What gives me hope is, it's so cliche, but my son. I have a 3-year-old little boy, and he's at an age where he sees difference between people, but he does not inherently ascribe a status to that difference. And so watching him grow has really been eye-opening for me with regard to the human potential to be unbiased and to see and fully recognize the humanity in every single person, regardless of their identities. That's not how we're born. We're not born with these blind spots of we're born with blind spots, but not with blind spots that ascribe a negative trait to different groups of people. And so I know we have the potential of moving back to that place.
Gwen, what about you? I mean, you can speak generally if you want to, but if you have a Kansas City specific observation when it comes to your thinking about the future, I'd love to hear it.
Sure. I'm hopeful as well. I think approaching race relations in Kansas City through using implicit bias as the approach to framing conversations around diversity and inclusion throughout the city is really important, especially having been involved in a number of activities locally, such as when Congressman Emanuel Cleaver was mayor, he formed a race task force, and the Urban League was tapped to guide this task force to deal with race relations. And we had all of these people involved and lots of conversations, but yet some positive outcomes, but we're still not where we need to be. When Kay Barnes was mayor, we had a race relations task force, and we had to bring people together to deal with some serious racial profiling incidents in the city. So we have a lot of work to do, but I'm hopeful that this approach will allow everyone to come to the table in the spirit of love and compassion and seeking understanding, as Robin said, as opposed to bringing a lot of fear, anxiety, distrust to the conversation that won't allow us to get to where we need to be to mitigate the damages of implicit bias.
Gwen, we have just about a minute left, but do you have something you've witnessed, like a personal or institutional transformation that you've witnessed?
A transformation as a result of implicit bias? No, I don't have a particular institutional example at this point. I mean, we're just getting started to do this work and be very intentional about using implicit bias as a process. So I really can't cite a specific example of how we've used it. We're working with Kerwin Institute all of next week in all of our sessions, and we'll begin to lay the groundwork. And hopefully we can come back in a few months or a year and tell you, look, we made some significant changes here.
I hope so, too. Well, Gwen Grant of the Urban League, thanks so much for your openness today. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
And Robin A. Wright, keep us posted on your research, and we'll look forward to having the Kerwin Institute's presence in our city next week.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Robin joined us from Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity.